Now, let's talk a little bit about the economy. Here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, the Dow has rallied. I mean, forget that it's up 600. Jason Turner, Chief Investment Strategist with Wintrust. Earlier today, it was down about 500, right?
Yeah, this is over a 1,000-point turnaround in the Dow just this morning. So it's been an interesting roller coaster.
And to what do you attribute that? By the way, our friend Tom Fortino a little while ago said he doesn't put too much stock, no pun intended, in even this kind of a swing on any given day. Maybe there's a danger in reading too much into this, but read into this, Jason. What's happening here?
Yeah, I'd agree. I wouldn't put too much stock into the large turnaround, although I can put some context to it. The pullback this morning was kind of driven off the open on the disappointing inflation print, inflation moving higher than we had estimated from a consensus perspective. But a pretty quick turnaround as investors started to think about what this means for some stocks, some categories of stocks going forward. The move up in oil has driven energy stocks to be a positive contributor. Banks, particularly this morning, have rallied significantly. And this is a bit of a realization that in a higher interest rate environment, and if we read the Fed minutes that came out this week as well, a higher interest rate environment that might persist for a period of time, bank stocks tend to do well in those type of environments. That's beneficial to financial services companies that make money off of the loan rates they're able to charge.
Yeah, right. Okay, well then, that doesn't say much about the health of the economy or the market generally, but the inflation's going up and everybody knows that. Banks can profit, and the increase in energy prices is maybe somewhat artificial since OPEC Plus and Russia seem to be doing business, right?
Yeah, with OPEC Plus's recent cut of oil production, I think that plays a lot into the energy price increase. And you're right, that's, let's call it artificial or short term. We didn't see the oil price really impact inflation to the positive, still, you know, dragging inflation back down. That'll turn around here as we're dealing with higher oil prices in October than we were in September, and it switches from a headwind to inflation to a tailwind, pushing inflation a little bit in the fourth quarter.
Well, let me just read you a line from the chief strategist at Schwab. She said investors may be betting that the stronger than expected inflation report means price increases will peak soon. We get this last gasp higher in inflation, and from there we start to decelerate. So do you think we've seen the highest inflation number we're going to see in this run?
Well, I'd agree with Liz's comment that she's expecting deceleration in inflation going forward. I think that's, we're on the cusp of that. I don't know that we've hit the peak here for the end of the year. We certainly peaked earlier this year over 9%, and I don't think we're going back there. We're still seeing some pretty significant pressure to inflation staying higher from shelter, which has about a six-month lag to when those home prices and rents really impact inflation. That doesn't really abate till the midpoint of the first half of next year, so March, April.
And why is that? Are we waiting for leases to come due? Is that part of it?
Well, some of it is leases coming due. A lot more of it, and shelter, broadly speaking, makes up 41% of the core CPI result. So the direction shelter takes from here on out really is going to define the direction of core CPI. It's also home price increases, and the way they calculate the CPI number, they try to turn those home price increases into an owner's equivalent rent. And that equivalent rent, while it's balance sheet positive for the investor who's sitting there with a fixed rate mortgage, it looks like a negative when you turn it into a CPI number. And that's why that number is going to stay a little higher than we're probably comfortable with into the early part of next year before it really starts to fall. Now, I think the fall could be a little bit more steep than the Fed's anticipating.
That's a good thing, right?
That'd be a good thing for the American consumer. Those inflationary pressures tend to hit us all directly into the pocketbooks. And once we see those pressures abate, that's when consumers will feel a little bit more confident about the economy and get back to spending.
Jason Turner's Chief Investment Strategist at Wintrust Wealth Management. Okay, Jason, thanks for your time today.
Thanks, John.
Joan Salzman catches us up on things technological, from CNET. Hi, Joan. How are you?
I am great. How are you doing?
Good. Amazon Prime Day was yesterday, or at least one of them. Did it go well? What were the big sellers?
Yeah. So yesterday and the day before was what Amazon referred to as its Prime Early Access sale, but everyone's calling it basically Prime Day Junior or Prime Day Number Two. And this time, when Amazon attempted to give, you know, its Prime members some special deals, as you'd probably expect, people were focused on sort of household essentials rather than spending on big ticket items like televisions or laptops. According to a couple research firms, one called Numerator, the average order size for the most recent sale was about $46, and that's down nearly a quarter from what people were spending in July. And people were focusing on household staples rather than the kind of big ticket things that Amazon probably hoped people would start spending in this sort of pre-holiday shopping, holiday, non-holiday sale.
Well, are we going to have another, we'll have their Black Friday or whatever their traditional Christmas day is, right?
Additionally, yeah. They'll do the whole Black Friday through Cyber Monday plus days at the beginning and days at the end. That whole onslaught is still going to happen. They were just looking for, especially with everyone dealing with tighter budgets, dealing with, you know, soaring inflation, they wanted to try to sneak in a way to get more people shopping before that onslaught hit.
Do you have some Netflix news for us today? I don't know that you do, but something was afoot.
I do. Yes, it happened right before I got on the phone with you. Netflix announced the details of its cheaper tier that introduces advertising for the first time. You know, Netflix grew to be the biggest service of its kind on partly on this model of no ads interrupting your streams. But now that it's facing so much competition and, you know, same theme, people are dealing with tighter budgets, it's launching a $7 a month membership where you save basically about $3 a month compared to its cheapest ad-free membership.
Mm-hmm.
But in exchange, you'll have those ad interruptions about 4 to 5 minutes every hour total.
Okay. 4 to 5 minutes an hour for $3 difference. I'm not so interested in the difference as I am the four minutes of ads an hour. Boy, this is what people are doing. They're going to make this calculation. $7 sounds good because we all have so many services, but damn, I don't want commercials. What are people going to do? What do you think of this offer?
Well, it'll be interesting. You know, Netflix was the trailblazer in streaming television. But since then, there have been, as you mentioned, all these new options that have come out. And invariably, these new options have a cheaper tier with advertising and a more expensive one that's ad-free. Netflix has become the one that's sort of the outlier that's not keeping up with the times. So this gets Netflix more in line with what its competitors are offering. It's also cheaper than a number of its main competitors for their ad tiers. They tend to be a little bit, if you're looking at like the HBOs and the Disney Pluses, Disney Plus is launching its tier $1 more expensive in about a month after Netflix launches it. But the question also is, you know, how many people have been paying Netflix all, you know, with their consistent price increases? How many people have been paying Netflix this much and now are going to grade down to the cheaper tier rather than Netflix actually bringing in new people?
Do you imagine Netflix will make it up in the advertising, right? So they'll lose revenue per person maybe, but they'll now have a new revenue stream, right?
That's a great point. All of these services really love their advertising tiers because they do make more money with their advertising subscribers because they can make that three, just speaking in terms of Netflix and speaking, you know, theoretically, that $3 of difference that you save every month on the monthly subscription, typically a service makes more than $3 a month off of you if you're watching ads. So it can be, in terms of revenue, in terms of bottom line, it can be really helpful to Netflix as a business if it follows those same trends.
I got just a few seconds left. Joan, anything you want to tell me about Microsoft? What's the headline there?
Well, Microsoft has been the latest in the parade of these big tech companies unveiling its new devices ahead of the holiday season. In terms of Microsoft, there is a, oh my goodness, see if I can keep it straight. There's a Surface Pro tablet, the Surface Pro 9, the Surface Laptop 5, and the Surface Studio 2 plus all-in-one. I know that's a little bit of number and word soup, but they've got basically a new tablet, new laptop, and new all-in-one computer that are faster and fancier than they were before.
I'll ask you more about those another day, but it's good to hear that so far. Thanks for your time, Joan.
Thanks, John. Great to talk to you.
Joan Salzman, senior reporter, CNET. Chef Jason Hamill joins us on the Wintrust Business Lunch, consulting chef to Marisol, the three-time nominee for the James Beard Award for Best Chef Owner of Lula's Cafe. This weekend, Saturday, Sunday, there's going to be a brunch and talk, which will be the maybe talk of the culinary town. It sounds delicious and really interesting, Jason. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
So tell us a little bit about that. What's going on this weekend?
Well, this weekend's a collaboration between me and Cliff Rome, who owns Peach's Restaurant on the South Side. Cliff and I became close in the pandemic as we were, you know, talking about how this situation is affecting restaurants. And, you know, all know that we went through quite a lot of turmoil during those times. And we became friends and colleagues. We decided to do sort of a collaborative brunch at Marisol, the meeting point between, you know, my place in Logan Square and his down in Brownsville.
So then before I ask you about the discussion you're going to have afterwards, can you tell me about the menu? I don't presume it's
sure,
a buffet.
Sure, of course.
Buffet.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, we love to express ourselves through food, right? So Cliff is contributing three dishes, and I'm contributing three dishes from our respective restaurants. And then Marisol at the MCA, which is located right there on the first floor of the museum, right as you enter, is doing its own dishes as well. So we all kind of came together and came up with a menu that would work well together during this time of year as we transition into the, you know, the pretty cold weather and, you know, fall for real. So we, you know, we're using a lot of fall ingredients and getting deep into the seasonality too.
So I'm looking at the menu, biscuit. Focaccia with rosemary, date sesame and pecan granola, baked salmon croquettes, sunflower hummus, potato crepes. And that's just the start. Talk about this a little bit. What's going to pop here?
I mean, the dishes that I love so much from both of these restaurants are popping up there at Marisol. So like the potato crepe, it's kind of like a marriage of what you would think of as a crepe and a laki. It's like shredded potatoes that are just lightly fried, stuffed with fall ingredients, leeks and mushrooms and apples. And then the salmon croquette from Peaches, which is a recipe from Cliff's family that he feels really, really proud of, and it's delicious. We're doing, you know, Marisol does a sunflower hummus that's well known and delicious. So, you know, we're bringing these things together in the spirit of collaboration and community.
A breakfast burrito with avocado, green chilies.
That's if you're real hungry. That one's a winner showstopper. They're full of organic eggs and potatoes and avocado with some great salsas on the side.
And then what are you guys going to talk about afterwards?
I mean, I think it's all about how restaurants interact with their neighborhoods. And both of us own neighborhood restaurants. We've been around for a while. My restaurant, Logan Square, is celebrating its 23rd year this year. And it's kind of about, you know, reflecting, especially after the pandemic when, you know, we went through a lot, just like what restaurants can do for their communities and vice versa, how communities can support their restaurants. And we're going to talk a lot about the experiences we have as owners and chefs getting through the pandemic and also like trying to understand like what we can do in the future to support communities. And we're talking, both of us have our own foundations that do charitable work in Chicago. Both of us are pretty committed to food education and teaching in the culinary world. And we see those kind of paths as a way of like connecting restaurants with their communities in deeper ways. You know, restaurants have always been, you know, the place on the corner where you go to get a bite to eat, but more and more as neighborhoods change and things change just, you know, in our world, like it's important for us to like realize like what connections we can make through food.
Not to get too philosophical or to denigrate other businesses, but restaurants really play a unique role in a neighborhood, don't they? I mean, it's really different. It's different.
I mean, especially, I mean, I'm biased from Chicago. I mean, especially in a neighborhood, a city so defined by its neighborhood, that the local businesses, the ones that sort of came up through through just, you know, the sheer ambition of its, of the residents. Like, I, you know, I'm a Logan Square resident. I wanted to start a place. I mean, same for Cliff. You know, we wanted to do something in our neighborhoods where someone could get a job and, yeah. and grow. And that's kind of what this is about. Like, why is it restaurants that do that in a neighborhood? Like, what is it about food? What is it about the kinds of jobs you can get at a restaurant and the growth that you can have that still, like, suggests that American dreams are, you know, are possible, you know?
Chefs Diana Browder, Clifford Rome, and our guest Jason Hamill putting together a community-inspired brunch, and that's going to be this weekend. You can find out more at MarisolChicago.com. Chef, congratulations in advance. What a good idea.
Thank you so much. Glad to have been on. So appreciative of it.
Our pleasure. It's more business news. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Two of the major grocery store chains serving Chicago could be merging. Bloomberg reports Kroger is in talks about a merger with Albertsons, and an agreement could be reached as soon as this week. Locally, that would mean Jewel and Mariano's would be co-owned. There are no details available about the possible deal, and any merger would face antitrust scrutiny. Kroger and Albertsons directly compete in much of the country. Earlier this year, Albertsons announced a strategic review of its businesses. A merger would create a company of comparable size and groceries to market leader Walmart. United Airlines is planning to add two new flights from Chicago to a pair of European cities next summer. The Chicago-based carrier has announced it will add daily seasonal flights from Chicago to Shannon, Ireland, and Barcelona, Spain, beginning May 25th. The routes are part of a broader expansion of United's international flights next summer after the airline reported a strong summer travel season. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
The business of food now, and Steve Alexander.
Yes, and we'll check in with our Ukrainian farmer friend, Nick Gordachuk, after I tell you that we're sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience life in HD. Visit ChevyDrivesChicago.com. Nick has two farms just outside Kyiv on which he raises mostly potatoes, sunflowers, and wheat, but he lives with his family in the city. And with the Russians rained missiles on Kyiv a few nights ago, they exploded just 7 blocks from his home.
We could even feel the wave in the apartment, but my children and my mother, they're all fine.
He says life in Kyiv had returned to close to normal after the Russians were driven out in April. But these last few nights...
It reminds you like a Second World War, you know, this really nasty noise. And reminds you that you have to do something, either run or hide. And it reminded the whole world again that we are fighting with criminals, with terrorists. And they don't care about civilians, about women, children, innocent people.
Nick has heard the calls from outside Ukraine for a ceasefire, but he says the only way the fighting will stop is if Russia stops. He says all Ukraine is doing is defending its land and people, and he believes only one thing will end it.
The war will not stop until Putin is thrown down in Russia.
Meanwhile, out on the farm, things are tight. Nick had to sell wheat at a loss, $3.50 a bushel, half of what he got last year. Potatoes are getting about 35% less than last year. And adding to the red ink, fertilizer is crazy expensive, something American farmers can relate to. But one thing American farmers don't have to deal with, Russian missiles being shot down during harvest.
Fragments of rockets fell on our fields yesterday. And we had to wait for about 3-4 hours just away from the field.
Still, the all-in war effort continues. Some of his tractor drivers were called up to fight in the war. People are donating cash and food and clothing and vehicles while still trying to do their work.
Many people united around the idea to kick Russians out of our country and to have to get back to normal life.
Our thoughts continue to be with you and your family, Nick.
Thanks a lot. And I would like to thank the United States for supporting Ukraine and standing with Ukraine during this terrible war that Russia started.
That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the challenges that working people have. Jane, your organization actually promotes these kinds of conversations, right?
We actually do, John, but we don't often get to talk to people as high up as you. So it's great to be here.
Oh, that'll work. But Jane, tell us a little bit about it, because I've heard the name, but I don't maybe know exactly what you do. Are you a forum? Is that what you are?
We are a nonprofit media outlet, and we're dedicated only to tell the stories about work, hence our name, Working Nation. But we give people the information they need to find quality programs for in-demand jobs.
programs for in-demand jobs. As an example, give me something.
So, for instance, if somebody wants to decide whether they want to be a welder or whether they want to be a plumber's assistant, they can often find information on our website about how much each of them make and how long it takes to get the credentials you need for each of those jobs. But we do blue-collar, no-collar, and white-collar jobs, and we do all ages. And, you know, from people entering the workforce for the first time to people who are career changers later in their lifespan.
What areas are most in demand? Where's the most fertile ground here?
Boy, you know, after last week's jobs report, it really shows that the recovery, regardless of inflation, the recovery has really hit all sectors. So there's great growth in healthcare. And, you know, while we think of doctors and nurses, there's gigantic potential everywhere for allied health, really good paying jobs, where you can get the credentials in 6 months to a year. So you don't have to, you know, do a 2-year degree or a 4-year degree. Mm-hmm. But I would say the other hot spot is both the sector of tech and the horizontal of tech. So you think about tech jobs at big companies, you know, like Apple and Google and Microsoft, but also those tech jobs in the utility company in your local area, in the hospital, in the school district in your local area. And again, lots of jobs for people with 4-year degrees and beyond, but great opportunity to start your career working, you know, with a quick credential that you can get at the city colleges there in Chicago or your community colleges, or quite frankly, online as well.
We haven't exactly bridged the gap between workers and available spots, right? What's going on there?
You know, I think some of it is just the mismatch of where the jobs are and where the people are. And people are less willing to pick up and move today than they were 25 years ago. They might, you know, they might have a house or a family, but I think it's much more about having a social network. You know, we talk all the time about individuals, women particularly, but men too, being really saddled with the cost of childcare. So if you have an in-law or a cousin or an aunt in your local area, you know, you're really reluctant to move somewhere where you lose that safety measure when you need childcare.
I've heard that too. I've also heard that there's a number of people who quit working and want to go back in, or were put on the sidelines and want to get back in, and are having trouble, and they cite their age. Is there a little ageism going on out there?
Oh, I think ageism is real. And even though it's against the law to discriminate on someone because of their age, really hard to prove it, right? Really hard to make a case that the only reason you didn't get a job was because you were older. But I think, you know, going to a third party, you know, whether it's the public workforce system, whether it's a nonprofit that specializes in people who are a little bit more mature, going and getting some help and really identifying employers who value your past experience. And by the way, John, I would say that people can work a little harder on their own with that. Think about your transferable skills. So, you know, I just heard on your show a little earlier that you were talking about United picking up and hiring and starting new routes. Mm-hmm. Well, the leisure and hospitality sector has really suffered. They're still down 1 million jobs since before the pandemic. So if you came out of that industry and are waiting to get called back by an airline, by a hotel, by a restaurant, whatever, and you should start thinking, instead of waiting any longer, what are your transferable skills? What did you do at that job that could give you a leg up in another sector, a sector that's on fire, like healthcare, or professional and business services? And I think all of us are too reluctant to switch sectors. I think you and I need to be out there saying to people, come back into the workforce and try something different, whether you're 35 or 65.
That's really interesting. Joan Oates is the president of Working Nation. Click on workingnation.com. Joan, come on again sometime. I'm out of time today, but let's visit more.
John, anytime. Thanks so much.